So, okay. So what we've been sharing this weekend and trying to develop, we call awareness. And most of the time when we talk about awareness or mindfulness or observing or knowing, we use those words synonymously. But in this talk, I want to distinguish between the activity of awareness and the function of mindfulness. So I'm going to make, there's going to be a slight shift of meaning in the use of the word mindfulness. So, you know, when we first hear about Dharma practice or meditation practice or mindfulness, we usually get instructions in a technique of, you know, turning your attention to the breath, focusing, and maybe naming your experience. And so we get a series of instructions, including a technique and a rudimentary why we do this, and the potential benefits and how to do it. And then we make effort, and we do what, you know what kind of effort we make when we begin. We try all kinds of things to follow the instructions using the technique to have some kind of experience called, well, mindfulness or calming the mind, or if you're really good and you do a 6 weeks or 8 week MBSR course, you'll be free of stress. That's so they say. And so it's a very goal-oriented, but technique, high energy or high effort endeavor. And yet, what we're talking about today is awareness. Relax, you don't have to focus. It can become a lifestyle of remembering to recognize the present moment as you move through all of life's activities. So I want to fill in the transition from techniquing, focusing, high effort, goal-oriented to relaxed, ongoing, no specific goal except a well-being, the transition to that. And it's called understanding the five controlling faculties, or the five spiritual faculties. Because the guiding of our awareness and the unfolding of awareness in our life really is guided most predominantly by what are called the five faculties. And these five faculties, I'm going to identify them and then talk about each one. The first is Saddha. In the Pali language is Saddha, which is usually translated as faith, but it really means confidence in the practical application of the word. It means having confidence. The second is Virya, energy or effort. The third is mindfulness as a mental factor, not as the activity of awareness, but mindfulness as a mental factor, which is really has the function to remember, and it has the characteristic of observing. So remembering to observe is mindfulness. And then the fourth factor is samadhi, which is really the development of a mental factor called ekagata, or single-pointedness. And samadhi is really the result of the continuity of remembering to recognize, or the continuity of mindfulness. And the Buddha said the tranquil mind, or the collected mind, the mind of samadhi, sees and understands things more clearly, which is wisdom. So these are the five factors I'm going to be speaking about. Saddha, confidence; Virya, energy; mindfulness, or sati, mindfulness or remembering; samadhi, which is stability of mind; and panya, which is understanding. The interesting thing about these five faculties is that they have a cause-effect relationship, so that With faith, we make effort. With effort, we become mindful. With mindfulness, or the continuity of mindfulness, we stabilize the mind. With stability of mind, we see and understand things more deeply, more clearly, more accurately. And when we have this kind of wisdom and this kind of understanding, we have more faith. This bolsters our faith and confidence. We feel affirmed, and we're willing to make, we have more faith, and we're willing to make more effort. More effort is more continuity of remembering. More remembering is greater stability of mind, resulting in, again, another increase in wisdom or understanding. And this in turn fuels the cycle of this cyclical cause-effect relationship, so that the development of these faculties can only be gradual. But it is inevitable. We can't have ultimate wisdom without having gone through this cycle several times and gotten familiar with the kind of energy that's needed, the kind of mindfulness needed, what stability of mind is, and the increasing realization of liberating wisdom that comes from insight. So we could say that awareness is the activity of these five faculties together. Mindfulness is one of the faculties, and it has a specific function, which I'll speak more about. So, somebody just asked me, how do you ever get involved in Dharma anyway? And maybe some of you have heard the story, but I was living in a commune in central Maine after dropping out of law school and trying to recover my sanity after 16, 17, 18 years of school. And so I was living in this commune, and the main glue of this commune was we were all Grateful Deadheads and Pink Floydians. And we were there living in the remote forests of Maine, partaking of the sacrament, and this was our spiritual life. And this was the only thing I understood as a spiritual dimension to life. And before, you know, at this time, I didn't know anybody who meditated. I didn't know anything about Buddhism. I had never meditated one minute. I didn't have any interest in Buddhism or religion or spiritual life. I was into the Grateful Dead, which satisfied all of those. You got to understand, you know, I was obsessed. Well, I mean, I was addicted, or I was, you know, whatever. Anyway, it was a lifestyle. And so one of the women in the commune got this book called Beginning to See by Sujata. Sujata was someone who practiced with Manindra in India at the same time Joseph was practicing there. He wrote these little one-liners about mindfulness, and Julie Wester, who's now a teacher at Spirit Rock, she drew these little string line ideographs to kind of depict that one-liner about mindfulness. So she read this book, or she was just looked through it, it's like a little cartoon book of one-liners, and she was kind of interested in it. She showed me the book, and I looked at it, and, oh, yeah, okay, So she wrote to the address in the back, Still Point Institute in California, and to inquire about where, something about this mindfulness meditation, and Julie wrote back and said, oh, there's a retreat going on in Maine right now, and in a couple of weeks, there's going to be a two-week retreat for new people. So we were living about an hour and a half from Bucksport, Maine, and you know, she said she wanted to go, and you know, in my totally unclear, befuddled state of mind, I thought she said she was going on something like a holiday, or at least was going to a place where you didn't have to work and you could kind of relax and, you know, kind of hang out and something like a cruise on land. So on the appointed day, we went to got in the car, drove to this old Catholic seminary or novitiate or something that had been rented, and we walked in, and we were coming into the middle of a retreat that had been going on for 2.5 months, and so there was a sign on the left-hand door we walked into the lobby, and on the left was a dining room. Sign on the door said, New students will meet at 4 o'clock or something. And on the right-hand side was the door to the chapel. And the chapel, we looked in the chapel, and there was, you know, 40 or 50 people sitting on the floor, meditating, looking in the other direction. and it was really quiet, and there were a few people walking around. They were wrapped up in blankets. It was early December. They're wrapped up in blankets. They're staring at the floor. They're sneaking around like snails. They won't look at you. They don't talk. We looked at the schedule on the door, and it said, 4 o'clock, wake up, and do your yoga, do some walking, sit, walk, breakfast, sit, walk, lunch, sit, walk, tea, sit, walk, sit, 7:30, talk, 8 o'clock, walk, or 8:30, walk, 9 o'clock, sit, 10 o'clock, further practice. We looked at each other and said, well, okay, from 7:30 to 8:30, it looks like we can talk, meaning we can actually listen. Well, we still weren't allowed to talk. So what we had done is we'd stumbled into the last 2 weeks of the first 3 month retreat taught by Joseph Goldstein, Jack Kornfield, and Sharon Salzberg. So, okay, like a fish out of water, we had to meet in the hall, and I chose to sit way up back, far away as I could get, closest to the door, leaning against the piano for 2 weeks. My body was in excruciating pain. It was just totally, not used to sitting still, not used to sitting on the floor, cross-legged, and it was miserable. And the mind was no better. The mind was detoxing, and it was having a hell of a time. It was not a happy camper. But when I heard the talks in the evening, talks about Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, mindfulness, awareness, and other things, traditional first course Dharma talks, it was as if I heard for the first time what I'd always known to be true. And I'd never heard it, I'd never read it, but it just went in there like, oh, that's right, this is the way it is. I get it. And there was no doubt, and there was no questioning. It was just like, yeah, sure. And I was amazed that somebody could know my interior so well. Well, okay, we were 2 weeks in this, the rare air of developing mindfulness and stillness and quiet and whatnot. At the end of the 2 weeks, I just got in the car, drove back to the commune. Arrived at the commune, everybody's there doing the same old thing. Nothing is different except we were. Our minds were in a totally different space, and we saw this very familiar community of friends that we've been living with for years, and we just go, wow. We just had a perspective on that lifestyle that was unavailable from inside, but having stepped out and gone to look at our own minds and try to understand our minds a little better, it just looked totally different. We just understood it in a completely different way. Gradually, over the next few years, we moved away from the commune and moved into the meditation center in Massachusetts, and that's where I spent the next 8 years. What happened on that retreat is my saddha, or what we call saddha, got awakened. And saddha has the function, or the proximate cause of saddha is having something to have faith in. But faith or saddha seeks the good. It looks for the good. It looks for the wholesome. So when our saddha, our faith gets awoken, we recognize wholesomeness. We see wholesomeness in others. We see good in others, and we aspire to that. We have confidence in that. We aspire to acquire or to become or to have or to grow into that kind of goodness. So what happened is I saw the possibility of, wow, my life, I couldn't have articulated this then, but it's like, oh, I saw the possibility that my life could be something other than just, dispersed dissipation of energy until a dead concert came around and gather up and get on the road. And it just provided us a perspective and a meaning and a purpose and a value to life that was not happening before that. So, with that amount of faith, that amount of confidence, with that amount of interest, really, then I went to the meditation center and started you know, volunteering and working and doing retreats and things like that. So first I went to do a work retreat. I did a 2-week work retreat, a 3-week work retreat. Then I applied to be on staff, and I came on staff. One of my first days on staff, I was up in the attic with Rodney Smith from Seattle. He was a staff person at the time. And we were insulating a dorm, the ceiling over a dormitory, so it'd be a little warmer in the winter. And we were having, you know, I'd done one 2-week retreat, and we were having a discussion about Nibbana. As if I knew anything about Nibbana, didn't know anything about Nibbana, except it was a word. But Rodney reminded me that I said to him, I have absolutely no doubt that I will realize the Dharma in this lifetime. I had no idea what I was saying. I had no idea what was going to be involved, but I had absolute faith and confidence that this practice could get me there. Faith like that doesn't rely on knowledge. But it's not true, it's not confident, unshakable faith, which has to be confirmed and grown with, grown through practice. So, but still, I had this kind of doubt, and I've never had anything but that. I mean, this kind of faith without any doubt, and I've never seen doubt in my practice. Never any doubt about the teachings, the teachers, the practice, the efficacy of the practice. The doubts that I had about myself were the usual, just kind of like, I'm an idiot, I'm too stupid, I'm too old, I don't have right energy, I don't understand, I don't know, you know. But that didn't stop me from practicing. So when we have this kind of awakening or opening of faith, then it clarifies our spiritual objective. You know, we know the direction to go to develop the good within us. Oh, okay, so when we understand that faith awakens this confidence, this clarity, this seeking, we should also understand that faith doesn't posit a goal or an experience to be reached so much as a direction to travel. And if we understand that our seeking the good and developing our spiritual life and becoming more awake and aware, in this case, is really a directional movement of the heart, because we can check out where we are at any moment, realize we're in the ditch, and realign our efforts and understanding towards the direction we want to go. It's not that we have to reach a certain goal or have a certain kind of experience or confirming anything. If we follow the direction of our aspiration and we keep going, we'll inevitably get there. So what happened to me after that first awakening, first retreat, is while at the retreat center and working and doing retreats and talking to teachers as they came through, I didn't really study. There wasn't too many books to study then or to read, and I wasn't interested in them. I just liked to sit quietly, you know. And I realize now, I didn't know it at the time, I thought I was trying to be mindful, but later I found out I had no idea what mindfulness was after 8 years of doing retreats. Still didn't know. But what was actually happening is I was slowly cleaning up my act. Slowly just weaned myself off. I didn't try to wean myself off drugs. It just ceased to be interesting. I stopped doing drugs, started having better sila, started connecting with community members on the staff at the meditation center, had clarified my aspirations, saw possibilities in my life that just were not apparent or available to me prior to that time. But with that kind of faith, of course, you can see I was willing to make the effort, make the energy, or arouse the energy to practice, to be on staff, to volunteer, and to attend as much of the retreats as I could as they were being held. Now, it is said that for energy, even though you have faith, or confidence, that isn't enough to kind of get you to practice unless there's a spark that says, gotta practice, and I have the faith so I can do it. And that spark is called samvega. San Vega is called spiritual urgency. So while we have confidence in the teachings, we may never make any move to traverse, to make the journey of awakening, unless we have some spark, some urgency to do that. Now, Samvega is a feeling of, it's not urgency like panic, so much as a recognition that there's something possible that we're not, that we don't have access to. There's some unknown thing, there's some mystery to life, there's something inside of ourselves that is calling for attention, and we feel moved to pursue practice, in this case, to reveal it. Often, you know, or for many people, it is a great loss. You lose a lover, you lose a parent, you lose a friend, you lose a pet, you lose a career, whatever. And it just, you know that feeling, you know, you have when somebody you know really well dies? You just, this big, empty, gaping, unknown hollowness in your heart opens up and it goes, nothing can fill it. Nothing can make sense of it. There's no rational, logical activity or belief that can do it. You realize, oh, there's something more to life. I don't know, whatever this is, it moves you to look, to yes, you keep your job, you keep your house, you keep your whatever it is, but there's another dimension to life that needs to be investigated, and that's the call to the spiritual awakening. So that spiritual awakening for me was just recognizing it, with that first retreat, was just recognizing, wow, there's others in the world that know something of value to me, and I wanted it. I really needed to hear the Dharma and practice the Dharma. And I, as I said, I worked at the retreat center off and on then for about 77 to 84. 7 years, 7 or 8 years, and doing retreats. Then I was doing a retreat in the winter one time, a self-retreat at the meditation center in early 85, and about the third or fourth day in the retreat, I was just laying down, and I was practicing mindfulness awareness, and I had this vision. Now, I'm not a woo-woo, wow-wow guy. Magical things don't happen to me. I don't have any visions. Nothing special ever happened. But I did have this vision of a shrouded being appearing visually in my mind's eye, and I could feel that it was a female face, but it was a skeleton. Of course, this could be all great, influenced by the Grateful Dead iconography. I know, but still, it was meaningful to me. And this voice said to me, the moment of death is the most important moment of your life. And, I mean, that kind of went zing, and I realized then that, you know, even after eight years of practice, I really didn't get it. I really didn't get what mindfulness was. I didn't have I liked to sit, but I didn't have any there was no ambition. It was just kind of like holding space or something. And I realized then that my life, I was a builder. I was a contractor, and I was building homes in Maine and doing a lot of renovations in Massachusetts. And, you know, I was, you know, my early adult years of becoming normal were well underway, and I just had this realization that, you know, more of this, you know, better jobs, newer car, more clothes, nicer restaurant meals, whatever, just wasn't going to work. That wasn't anything that I wanted to do with my life, and the only alternative was I want to do more practice. So I said, well, I've had friends who've gone to Asia and practiced, you know, ordained as a monk for a year or two, and I'll do that. So it was like, I didn't even have to speculate or think about it. It was just like, click, click, click. Moment of death is the most important moment of your life. Yeah. The way my life is going, I don't need more of this. More of this is not going to do it for me. Click. I'm going to Beijing to ordain and practice. Click. Okay. So then I got up and had lunch and went on with the rest of my retreat. But it was decided. It wasn't like I had to consider it or decide it. It was just like, that was what my heart said. That's what my mind said. And I was off. When we have this kind of urgency, we're willing to make any effort. And when I went to Burma to practice, I went for a few reasons. One was I wanted to practice intensive mindfulness awareness until I didn't want to practice anymore. And I didn't know how long that was going to take. I wanted to ordain as a monk because I thought, well, that'll be an interesting thing to do. And I wanted to live in a Buddhist country to see what these teachings would do to a whole country. So I went to Burma. Upandita was the only person I knew in Asia. He'd come to America in 84. So I went to Burma. And when I got there, I was on fire. Nothing in my life mattered except get on the cushion, practice. I wasn't interested in looking around Rangoon. I wasn't there as a tourist. I wasn't to sample the food. I didn't do anything. Got off the plane, spent one day getting some essential things I need, got to the monastery. And that was it. I thought I'd just ordain there, spend a month or two, then go to Thailand, hang out in the forest and do my practice. But somehow I got connected to Bandita and that kind of practice, and I was hell-bent for Nibbana. I guess that's what you'd have to say in kind of colloquial language. And, you know, it's just like I had so much energy and so much interest and so much faith. It was too much, actually. So the schedule there is wake up at 3, go to bed at 11 at night, alternate hours of sitting and walking for 20 hours a day. And they weren't kidding. That's what was expected of you. So I said, okay, set that old alarm, 4 o'clock, and for 4 hours, get up, start practicing. One day, I don't know, you know, and I was diligent about just do the 4 hours. But one day, I don't know, maybe I set the alarm for 5 hours, or maybe I shut it off. I don't remember what, but, you know, 5 hours. Okay, so every day I was reporting to Pandita, and you know, I'd go in at 2 o'clock, do my bows, tell him about my practice, he'd get it translated, and it would come back, and it'd be some little adjustment, some little instruction or encouragement to continue, and it was going along. So this day, you know, it was, you know, I don't know, I'd been a couple of weeks, 2 or 3 weeks into the practice, and I did 5 hours. So I come to the door of his cottage, I open the door. I usually walked in and went and walked like over to that corner, did my bows and to him and sitting in his chair and then give my report. And this day I walked in, I opened the door, walked in, stood there. He looked, from over there, he looked at me, said, how many hours did you sleep last night? And I go, well, I wanted to say I always sleep only 4, but that night I slept 5. How the hell do you know that? So I said, well, 5 hours last night. Please try harder. Interview's over. Okay. Right. You know, when you're practicing with somebody who knows your mind that well, you got nothing to hide. You know, whatever judgment you have of what's going on in your mind is useless because it's written all over you somehow. And working with him, it's such a relief. Here's somebody that knows your mind better than I did. And he didn't have any shame about what was going on in my mind. He didn't have any embarrassment. He wasn't judging it as good or bad. He was just saying, this is what you got to do if you want to practice. Well, that's kind of the transmission I got. It's like, stop judging. What you think is good practice, that's not it. What you think is bad practice, that's not it. Just keep practicing. And that's the way I practice. Energy like that has the... what's it called? It's the energy like that manifests as non-collapse. Non-collapse. That's the manifestation of effort, virya. Now, you know what collapse is. This is a visual teaching. You have to be looking at me to see this. So we're going along. We're going, yeah, rising, falling, noticing this. No, oh, pain. Yeah, it's pain. Pain. Oh. That's collapse. Where the mind goes, because of its pain, or because of its fear, because of its shame, because of its whatever, you just go, I don't want to look. You just collapse. The energy collapses, and you lose the thread of mindfulness, of awareness. So effort, energy, has this non-collapse, or this is its manifestation, its characteristic. Now, you know, if somebody was just, as we give instruction in the, you know, in the sitting, and we just say, okay, settle in and pay attention to this, check your awareness, check your attitude of mind. If you hear that, you can do it. You know, you're prompted to, oh, check your attitude. Okay, what are you aware of? Right, is the mind aware? Right, okay, check your posture, yeah. Oh, how about your emoji? How's your emoji? Okay, got that. Okay, so as long as there's an instruction, or as long as there's a direction, it's easy to be mindful, right? Just do what you're told. But what's difficult is to remember to be mindful, to remember to observe, to remember to acknowledge and recognize what's going on. So that is the that's the function of mindfulness. Okay, so a large part of our early work is to internalize the instruction, how to practice awareness by remembering to recognize present moment's experience. And it takes a lot. We have to hear the instructions and internalize them, remind ourselves, prompt ourselves over and over and over again. And we forget to prompt ourselves when we get lost in our usual personality dynamics of, you know, fear and anger and judgment and depression and despair and hopelessness and whatever it is that we are not yet aware of in our life. Because when we're not aware and we're caught up in some of these entangled, confused, defiled fantasy obsessions, well, you don't remember to recognize the present moment's experience. And so every time we do remember, we plant these seeds of remember, 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 then gradually we start to expose all of these unconscious habits of mind, all of these, you know, fantasies that we invest all our desire in, all of these hurt and all of the hurt that we get angry about, and we're judgmental about, and we're frustrated by, and disappointed by, and all of the self-pity, everything that we don't yet see about our inner life. Okay, so as Ramana Maharshi says, no one succeeds without effort. Mind at peace is not your birthright. Those who succeed owe their liberation to perseverance. Same as Saito Tejaniya. He says, it's not difficult to be aware or mindful. It is difficult to maintain it continuously. And for this, you need right effort, which is simply perseverance. Now, perseverance is not grim. The balanced effort is something between patience with what arises due to conditioning, habit, and perseverance, which is just keep going. Right effort is somewhere in there. Accepting the mind is not yours. It's going to throw up all kinds of stuff, but you're responsible for it. Persevere in just recognizing it. So that's our guidelines to making right effort. Now, another one of my spiritual teachers during the last century, seems like a long time ago, but not that long ago, was Carlos Castaneda, and his teachings from Don Juan. Really, just fantastic Dharma in there. So Carlos writes, Don Juan had assured me that in order to accomplish the feat of making myself miserable, I had to work in a most intense fashion, and that it was absurd. I had now come to realize that I could work just the same in making myself complete and whole and strong. The truth is in what one emphasizes, he said. We either make ourselves miserable or we make ourselves strong, the amount of work is the same. Okay, that's a wake-up call. We have to work hard to make ourselves miserable. And if we worked as hard to make ourselves aware, to remember, to recognize, then it doesn't take any more energy. Okay. So with this energy of not collapsing, practicing mindfulness, we remember to recognize the present moment. To remember is the function of sati. Sati is what we call mindfulness, but now here I'm distinguishing the mental factor of sati from the activity of awareness. Sometimes we call them mindfulness, sometimes we call them awareness, but the function of this mental state, sati, is to remember. Okay? And what is it we remember? Well, the characteristic of the function of mindfulness, the function of sati is to remember, the manifestation of sati is to observe. So we remember to observe. Meaning, I don't mean to observe with our eyes, but I mean to observe, to feel, to touch with the mind, to touch this moment's experience, to remember to touch this moment's experience, to really become intimate with this moment's experience. And then it is perception that will recognize it as something familiar or something that's new, something we've never experienced before. So mindfulness and perception of recognition remembers to observe and recognize present moment, and it doesn't collapse moment to moment to moment. Okay. So I've been practicing in the monastery in Burma for some period of time. I don't know if it was after a year, if it was in my second year, I can't remember. I stayed there for 5 years. But somewhere I was practicing, and I remember walking on the backside of the dormitory, the little bungalow where I live, where foreign monks live. And I was walking one afternoon, and doing slow motion walking like we did there, and I noticed something in my experience that wasn't familiar. What's that? So I kept walking, and there it was again. And over the course of the next, few days or hours, I don't remember, I just became familiar with this feeling of collapse. Huh. So I'd be walking and there'd be this, something would cross the mind and my energy would collapse. And I would have this thought or feeling or kind of a, it wasn't really a clear thought, it was just a feeling of, oh poor me. I'm too old, I can't do this. Or, oh poor me, I started too late in life. Oh poor me, I'm too stupid. Oh poor me, I'm just inadequate, it's just impossible. Oh poor me, I can't do this, I did too many drugs. Oh poor me, I can't do this, I didn't do enough drugs. the mind will say anything. Yeah, the mind will say anything to justify, there, I can stop. It's useless for me. Why bother? Well, I called this self-pity. I don't know if that's self-pity, but I called it self-pity because I was like, oh boy, me. And I just said, what? I've never seen this before. I was still only in my 20s. Or I was 35 at that time, 35, 36. And I was like, what do I mean, oh poor me? I'm young, I'm confident, I'm full of arrogance. Pride, or I just whatever. I wasn't going to wallow in self-pity, but I'd never seen it before in my life. But now I was seeing it, and I got so I was so fascinated by it and so interested in it that I would catch it every time. Every time, the instant my mind would go, I'd go, and it would be going, I was just on it, not with aversion. I was just like, I recognized it quickly. I was fascinated by it. It didn't get a toehold. And I did that for, I don't know. I don't know if it was a couple of weeks or a couple of months, but I haven't seen it since. And that's not to say that my life has not had given me lots of opportunities to wallow in self-pity. There's lots of opportunities. you know, conditions just come around that are hard to bear. And you want to just say, you know, that kind of, oh, poor me. And my mind doesn't go there. It doesn't even entertain it. It doesn't even see that as a possibility. This is what mindfulness does. Mindfulness remembers to observe and to take note of what's going on. And if it's never seen something before, it makes a note. Oh, this is what it's like. This is what it feels like. This is what it does. This is, you know, and eventually you'll get a name for it. But anything that you've seen once, the second time you see it, it's a little quicker recognition, and third time more quickly recognized. But this is how mindfulness uncovers what we've never seen about ourselves. And there's lots in there. Both wholesome and unwholesome. But this is what mindfulness does. And as the mind, let me see where I am in the whole conversation here. Oh, yeah, this, I want to mention this too. The other thing about, the other thing about mindfulness as a factor is if mindfulness remembers, observes, and recognizes this moment, clearly recognizing this moment, taking either knowing its name or knowing its qualities and characteristics at least, then that is the proximate cause for the next moment to be mindful. So the proximate cause for the continuity of mindfulness, clear perception, clearly recognizing what this moment is. Now, we've been talking about the object that's being known. A lot of times, the clarity of the object serves that purpose. You can clearly know, oh, that's breathing in, or that's pain, or that's a thought, or that's an emotion, and you clearly know that. If you clearly know that, the next moment you'll be mindful. You'll also be remembered to recognize that moment, the next moment. But you can also clearly perceive or recognize awareness. Object being known. You can notice the object, you can notice the knowing. So it's not that you have to grind your mind into the object. You can be relaxed and recognize the knowing or the awareness equally well. The clarity of that perception will condition the mindful remembering to recognize the next moment's clear perception, awareness. So this is how we develop a continuity to mindfulness. We develop a continuity of remembering to recognize, because we clearly recognize moment by moment, then the stability of the mind, the mind that is there and recognizing this moment and this moment and this moment and this moment and this moment is stable. The mind, an unstable mind, is a mind that goes, you know, notices this, then goes off and thinks about it. Oh yeah, that was a good breath. Yeah, okay, was that good? Wait a minute. Okay. Next moment, thinking. Yeah, I was thinking. I wonder what I gotta do to stop it. Wait a minute, come back in. Oh, now what's going on? So that's not a stable mind. That mind is very labile and it's just all over the place, right? Without being aware, without remembering to recognize what's going on. So that kind of restlessness, that kind of agitation in the mind is the opposite of stability of mind. Stability of mind really refers to the continuity of remembering to recognize, the mindfulness. So the more continuous the mindfulness is, the greater the samadhi. Now we call samadhi, often we call it concentration. When you hear the word concentration, you kind of want to go, grab your mind, squeeze it into a ball, force it through this little hole, and look at the breath.
I see it, I do.
You know, like you're concentrating the mind by kind of packing it into a ball and putting it on the object. That's not concentration. That's a headache. Right? What we a better word for it, and Saito Tejaniya calls it stability of mind, but it is collecting the mind. So it's like the mind that is dispersed thinking about this and thinking about that, judging what you're experiencing, and was I mindful or not mindful, and you know, last time I was mindful, and should it be the breath now, or should I go to this pain? If the mind is dispersed, thinking about all those things, it's not stable, it's not collected. It's like, okay, you know when you get a catalog in the mail? You get a catalog in the mail, and here's this little 60-page booklet that arrives at your door of things that you've never needed until today. Okay? So you look at this catalog, you go, oh yeah, page one, there's, you know, six or eight things on this page, and your eye goes scanning, yes, no, maybe, yes, no. Next page, another 10 things, no, maybe, okay. Next, yes, no, maybe. So you go through 60 pages of that, you know, and you've got 250 items you looked at. At the end of the looking through the book, your mind is totally dispersed because you've left a little piece of your mind on every item you've looked at. And especially the ones that you had a yes, you've gotten attached to, and so your mind is still holding on to that object. That new sweater, that new car, or that new whatever it is that you... So you get to the end of it, and you have no mind. You have no mindfulness at all. Totally dispersed, totally it's an unpleasant feeling, and the way to get rid of that feeling is to buy something. Because as soon as you select something on one page, all of your energy goes there, and you get obsessed and attached. It's like, that's the one. That's what I want. Fill out the form. And your mind gets collected again. Right? But other than that, it's just dispersed. It's just dispersed and has no power to resist the defilement of attachment or aversion or judgment. So when the mind is not continuously mindful, remembering to recognize, then it gets dispersed. And when it's dispersed, it's not stable. When it's not stable, it is vulnerable to being overwhelmed by any of the defilements that just happened by. This is the problem. Okay, so the stability of mind is what, this is continuity of mindfulness. The stability of mind is what keeps us both physically stable and steady and mentally continuous, recognizing this moment and the next moment. Awareness. Now, when the mind is, or when our awareness, or mind, I'm going to call it the mind, is that continuously mindful, and it's very stable, and it's connecting with this moment, without dispersing in between, the collected mind that lands on this experience, this sensation in the body, or this emotion in the heart, this thought in the mind, is very powerful. It's like the mind becomes like a super microscope. It's not that it sees small things, but it sees with the power of a magnifying lens really. And so when you look at any of these things, any of these experiences, momentary experiences, you understand, you see it in more detail. And in that seeing, you understand it. You have some recognition of it, that there's greater... A more accurate understanding of what it is you're seeing, what it is you're experiencing. And this is where you understand what is wholesome and what is not wholesome. You know, we've got all kinds of conditioning that says, this is good, this is bad, this is good, this is bad, whether it's your origin, you know, your religion of origin, your family of origin's religion, or the government, or your teachers, or whatever. And we've got all kinds of spin meisters in our head saying, do this, don't do that, this is good, this is bad, yes, do this, don't do that. And, you know, we're just so full of views and opinions, we don't know what we think. We don't have to think. We've got others' views and opinions to do it for us. Okay, now you're seeing your experience with a very powerful mind, whether it's seeing your memories and the pain and the hurt and the, you know, the justification for the anger and fear and attachment that you had then, or whether you're seeing your fantasies of the future with all your attachment and fear and hopes for that. And the present moment too. And so when you see things with that degree of collectedness of mind, you understand, this is not wholesome. This is wholesome, that's not wholesome. And you start to correct the misunderstandings, the assumptions, the wrong beliefs that you have acquired through conditioning throughout your life, because now the clarity of your own mind, having heard right view, to be able to practice in this way, now is confirming right view. Oh. So gradually you get this understanding about yourself, about your experiences, about experiences from the past that have conditioned a lot of pain and suffering and fantasies of the future that you now realize that's hopeless. That fantasy's not gonna work. This is clarifying your wrong views, clarifying your misunderstandings. Got to bring them into view to see. But it's not you who says, I like it, I don't like it. It's like wisdom says, yes, no, or maybe. It's wisdom that says that. When you get that kind of clarity about your life and about some of the personal experiences you've had, and you know, kind of seeing things as they really were, not as you were told they should be, then when you see that for yourself, man, your faith and confidence in practice to clear your mind and to lead you in a wholesome direction becomes inflamed. Yeah, you just have so much confidence in practice that you want to practice more. You want to practice more continuously. You want to clarify your mind. You really want to see what's going on. You want to purify your understanding of these kalesas, these tormented states of mind. This is the way that, boy, where am I in the notes? I don't know. Okay. So as the mind gets stable, we see things more clearly and we gain insight. Insight is, you know, how do we gain insight? You know, when you read about some of the scientists and how some scientific discoveries happen, somebody's dwelling on a problem, they've looked at this problem for 10 years and they know everything about it, something hasn't fallen into place yet. They haven't realized the truth that is hidden in all of this data. They've been doing the research, they've been paying attention, they've collected years worth of observations. They have a lot of knowledge about whatever the issue is, but it hasn't kind of gone click, oh, that's it. Whether it's how to depict the DNA double spiral, or whether it's, you know, how to understand gravity because an apple fell from the tree and landed right there. It's like a lot of apples had fallen from trees and nobody had ever recognized gravity before this guy goes, huh, must be something called gravity here. Okay, well, this kind of insight we get in our own life about our own mind's processing. You know, we have this processor in here that's kind of making sense of the world, making sense of our life's experiences. Wrongly, much of the time, and because of conditioning. You know, the conditioning we get from our parents and our society and our education and our political system serves their function very well. But if you want to be free, and if you want to stop suffering, you're going to have to do that on your own. Right? That's not your parents. Your parents just want to get you happily out of the house. I mean, they have love. They love for you, of course. You know, that's true. But still, they can't do it for you. You know, they do things that serve their role of parenting. Same as the government. You serve their role for their need for you. But if you want to be free and you really want to stop suffering, then you have to do this work on your own. I mean, you can do it in a group like this. You can have teachers and guides, but you got to see for yourself what's actually going on. You know, the interesting thing about the continuity of mindfulness, I'm going to backtrack to the stability of mind for a minute. You know, stability of mind, I said, is continuity of mindfulness, continuity of remembering to recognize. The proximate cause for samadhi is happy comfort of mind and body. Happy comfort of mind and body. That means relax. Relax the body, that's happy comfort of body. Happy comfort of mind is don't force your mind to do anything. Just let your mind be there, be at ease with your mind. No agenda. Happy comfort of mind and body is the proximate cause for just the mind remembering to recognize the next moment. Continuously. So what's with this practice of like, happy, comfort of mind and body? I don't think so. Right? I mean, I practiced Zen once. That's no more comfortable than than what we do. But. Okay, so the proximate cause of concentration or samadhi is sukha, and the development of wisdom comes through the continuity of the stability of the mind, seeing more clearly, more deeply into what is actually going on. Now, we talk about these objects that are being known. Sensations, thoughts, emotions, mental states, and awareness itself being recognized. There's a lot to be learned from objects. Objects can teach you a lot. But what we see eventually, what the nature of Vipassana insight is, after we've kind of disassembled or depixelated our personality and kind of reconstructed a self that's kind of more in line with the Buddha's teaching, a non-self, we begin to see in all of this activity that every object and every moment of awareness is impermanent. It's impermanent. That means every object, everything you've ever experienced, everything you've ever experienced has passed away. Everything you ever will experience is only going to be a momentary knowing, and it's going to be over. Everything. If we see this truth of impermanence, if we see this characteristic of impermanence, the mind ceases to hang on to anything. Doesn't hang on to the past, doesn't hang on to fantasy of the future, doesn't hang on to what's happening in the present. It learns, Vipassana is learning how to grieve effectively. Because we see the end, we see the impermanence of everything. And this isn't just an idea, it's an experience. You know, you're experiencing this, it's gone. Experiencing it, it's gone. Experiencing this, it's gone, 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 gone. Things just go. Wow. The only way you can see that, grow into that realization, is to let go, let go, let go, let go. And to let go means to basically grieve the loss of that, grieve the loss of that, grieve the loss. Accept the loss. When we accept the loss, grieving ends. Oh, okay. Now think about it. If that's the understanding that is arising in the mind through insight, what are you going to want to hold on to for your stability, for your security, for your sense of self, for your safety? There's nothing. There's nothing. There's no experience. There's no understanding. There's no person. There's no achievement, there's no accomplishment, there's no thing, no mental state that you can hold on to for this enduring happiness that we seek. Okay? That's one insight. Second insight is the insight into dukkha. Now, dukkha means pain, obviously physical, mental pain. It means the insecurity of changeable things. And it means the oppressive nature of being constantly having to care for sight, sound, smells, taste, touch, thoughts. You can't shut them off. You cannot shut off the sense doors in the mind. Temporary relief through some concentration practices, yes, coming to mind, yeah, but you can't shut it off. Okay, so when you see and you realize that every experience, every moment of every experience has this characteristic of dukkha. It's either painful, that's quite a lot of stuff, or it's unstable. Even if it's pleasant, it doesn't last. It's unstable. You can acquire all the pleasantness you want, and that's not the same thing as happiness, because it's not reliable. Okay, so when you see that every experience you have is either painful, or it's unstable, or it's just oppressive, it's just kind of badgering your sense doors in your mind, what among all that are you going to want to hold on to? You're not going to try to hold on to anything that's painful, or you're not going to rely on anything that's unstable, and anything that's oppressive is like, get me out of here. And this is a realization that Vipassana insight comes to. This understanding of the truth of dukkha. It's not just dukkha. The experience of dukkha is painful. But the understanding of dukkha is liberating. Okay? So we see impermanence. We realize the nature of impermanence. We realize the nature of dukkha, or the characteristic of dukkha. And we realize the nature or the characteristic of anatta. The anatta characteristic is we see that things have no inherent essence. Things are composed of other things, each of which is also composed of other things. Everything is conditional. Our sense of self is conditional. This body is conditional. This mind is conditional. Everything is conditional. It has no inherent substance that you can rely on to be there and control in any way. So what we think of as our body, of our mind, of ourself, we see, can't control. You can't control it. You can't make it do. You can't stop it from doing what it does. It does what it's conditioned to do, given known and unknown conditions. We were over lunch, we were talking about epigenetics, how epigenetic conditioning is like, you have no idea what your great-grandparents went through living in through the potato famine in Ireland and, you know, back in the 1600s or whatever. But it's the reason you have the diet problems you do. What? Yeah, hello. That's epigenetics. And genetics is bad enough or immediate enough, but epigenetics is like further removed but has equally conditioning effect on the present moment, our bodies. So it's like, what makes you think it's your body and your mind? Once you realize this through insight, this is what you see, this is what you come to, through Vipassana insight, you realize it's hopeless. So why hold on? Why try to figure out? Why try to find the real you in here, the essence of you? It's deeply conditioned and ever-changing, and it's got the dukkha characteristic anyway. Okay. Have I kind of painted a nice rosy picture for you? No, really, it's rosy. I'm going to tell you why. Because once you understand, once you realize and have this understanding, things are impermanent, don't grasp. Things are dukkha characteristic, don't hold on. Things are anatta characteristic, can't control that. When you really accept these understandings, these insights, these understandings, your mind doesn't reach for to hold on to anything. Now you remember the second noble truth? Dukkha, caused by craving, holding on. If you're not craving, you're not holding on, there's no dukkha. No dukkha. Third noble truth? There is the end of dukkha. There is the end of craving, and there is the end of dukkha. That means no more suffering, no more insecurity, no more oppressiveness, no more instability, free. The mind is freed of these confusions, delusions, and it is freed when the understanding of these three characteristics is mature, and we aren't reacting against it, we're not kind of like overwhelmed, we're not bugged out about it, we're not freaked out, we're not kind of wishing it wasn't otherwise, we're not also, oh, self-pity, poor me. No, we're just like, this is the way it is. Wow. And the mind is non-reactive, and it's in a very balanced, equanimous state. It is at this time that the mind might fall into the unconditioned. The unconditioned is nibbana. It's not caused by anything. It's unconditioned. It's not caused by anything. There's no conditions that give rise to it. But if we let go, or if there is enough letting go through this understanding of these three characteristics, the mind can fall into the unconditioned. Might. Trungpa put it right when he says, you know, enlightenment is an accident. Practice makes you accident prone. And it's true. You can't make it happen. You can't make it happen. But you can practice. And if you practice well and you realize these understandings, maybe you'll have an accident. And fall into the unconditioned. Why is it so important to fall into the unconditioned? Because it uproots the tendency of to resort to the defilements as a way of life. So we stop resorting to doubt. We stop resorting to desire. We stop resorting to aversion. We stop resorting to self-pity. We stop resorting to depression, anxiety, frustration, panic, all those things. We stop resorting to those. You see how we arrive at non-suffering? How we arrive at peace? The characteristic of the unconditioned is peace. Peace. Not just tranquility, not joy, not bliss, not even equanimity. Peace. This is the realization of the third noble truth. And the way to realize that third noble truth is just what we're doing here. The three trainings of the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path is, you know, the path to be developed to realize the third noble truth. What are they? Well, purify your speech and behavior through sila, or keeping the precepts. That purifies your speech and behavior, the transgressive defilements that hurt others. That gives us the happiness of living in harmony. That's good. Practicing mindfulness, if continuous, it develops purity of mind. A moment of mindfulness is a moment of pure mind, where we're not obsessing due to any defilement. We're not obsessively thinking what we want to do, but we can't because we're taking the precepts. Mm-hmm. We're no longer obsessing. Mindfulness suppresses the obsessing of defilements. And it gives us the happiness of seclusion, the mind that's tranquil, calm, not obsessing, not agitated with obsessing. But because conditions change and you never know if you're going to be able to be mindful of everything, the third training is the practice of vipassana, or insight. And what we do with the practice of insight is we purify our understanding, our misunderstandings, and we purify our understandings by realizing these three characteristics. We live our life as if things are permanent. We live our life as if we're in control. We live our life as if I could get what I want, then I'll be happy. It doesn't work that way. So when we purify our misunderstandings with these insights into anicca, dukkha, anatta, you can see, that's where you fall into the unconditioned. So it's these three trainings, just what we're doing here, practicing mindfulness, being nice, not screaming and hollering and acting out in ways that cause harm. We're kind of getting a look at the obsessing in our mind and dampening it down a little bit. We're beginning to understand, oh, this is the way things are in the body, in the mind. And that understanding will uproot the tendency to resort to all of these defilements in time. The Buddha was a master at how did somebody look at this crazy mind and come and realize this is the way it is? Well, we hear this. Everything I just said is right view. Okay? It's right view. But we don't know that. It's just a belief to us. It's like we can believe it or not until we practice. If we practice with these understandings, we will confirm these understandings. And you know, the interesting thing is, if you have the faith, if you have the confidence that this practice will do that for you, or has done it for someone, the Buddha, or maybe others, if you have the faith and you aspire to realize the end of suffering, the end of your suffering, your personal suffering, nobody can stop you. Nothing can stop you. Really. If you're patient with the way things are and you're persevering in your efforts, there's nothing. No, how can anyone stop you? What can stop you? Whatever you face as an obstacle is another place to be aware. And it's the awareness that's going to result in understanding. When your understanding of the true nature of things grows, Sayadaw Tejaniya says, your values in life will change. When your values change, your priorities will change as well. And through such understanding, you will naturally want to practice more. And this will help you to do well in life. So let's just let the words all settle in, settle down into our hearts. We'll sit for just a minute or two. There is nothing more interesting than using the Dhamma in your daily life. People don't use the Dhamma that much in daily life because they don't know the value, the quality, and the inherent worth of the Dhamma. Someone who really practices in daily life will know the value of this practice as something they can't live without. Therefore, you should think of your home as a retreat center. So thank you for listening to the Dhamma. Sometimes I get something like this Southern Buddhist hellfire and brimstone. Sorry, you know, I could say it with all kind of, but it's true. So, hey. So why don't we take?